What's the easiest way to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables? Balance of Nature. By simply removing the water and air, Balance of Nature can take 31 whole fruits and vegetables and put them into quick and easy to eat capsules. With just 3 fruit capsules and 3 veggie capsules, you get the equivalent of over 10 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. That's a lot of stored energy that your body will love. So if you're looking for an easier way to get clean energy, go to balanceofnature.com and order your bottles of sunshine today. Don't wait to see what getting over 10 servings of whole fruits and vegetables every day can do for you. Right now, Balance of Nature is offering free shipping and 35% off on any new preferred order of fruits and veggies. Start your journey to better health today by calling 1-800-246-8751 or by going to balanceofnature.com and make sure to receive this special radio offer by using discount code KATE.
Talk lines are open now. Call 888-673-1450. This is the Kate Daly Show.
Here we go. Is that how you guys are feeling? Yeah. And the silly, nighttime curfews and stuff. See, that came off the same social distancing ridiculousness from Bill Gates, even though none of it was ever proven, is because, you're around less people location-wise, you don't travel as much, so that factored in as well. So no one's going around and spreading it late at night. Give me a break. But they have curfews, right? Right? You couldn't even go out and have fun if you wanted to. So everything's closed. That's how ridiculous it all is. It's insanity. Sorry, I'm trying to get there. So I just wanted to mention, there is some stuff falling apart a little bit. And one of the things is that the person that came out and said 500,000 deaths in America due to COVID, oops, now he's saying oops. Oh, I guess I got that wrong. Walking it back. You've got Cuomo that was caught stockpiling ventilators. And when trucks pulled up to say, we'll take those refrigerated bodies because you don't have any other place to put them. Actually, he said, if I need them. You know how many serious cases he has? And not all these people would be on a ventilator today. Do you know how many cases of the serious in New York? 1,386. That's how many cases where they have other illnesses going on. They've already got other stuff going on. And a small portion of those are critical. It would need a ventilator. 1,386 in New York. Does it sound like he's running out? I think they have plenty of hospital beds in New York, and I think they have plenty of ventilators in New York. We don't have a ventilator shortage. No, not with this many people. We only have between 3,000 and 5,000 serious to critical people. That doesn't even mean they're in the hospital, you guys. It just means that their case is more serious because they might have a couple more things going on, but they tested positive for COVID. A lot of people could test positive for COVID. It could even be a false positive. So there's some things that are just kind of falling apart like that. And, Justin Trudeau in Canada was trying to push it to Earth Day. Oh, while you're all locked down and I'm in complete control of you, I'd like you to turn everything off for an hour to honor the Earth. And everybody laughed at him. So there's that. And there's a lot of stories right now in the news. Look into the fine print. Go down and look in the fine print. You'll find it. I had a whole section I was going to do on BlackRock, too, but maybe I'll save that for tomorrow. My son is a senior. That's all gone to hell. No senior ball, no graduation, no nothing. In fact, can't even get together with your friends because the other friends' parents are like, full Nazi about it. Oh, social distancing, even though it makes no sense and they're perfectly healthy. They can't even get together. It's crazy out there, you guys, and we're buying into it left and right. Based on what? A computer model that was put together by Bill Gates' people in Washington. study that's going on right now, and we're the guinea pigs. We're the lab rats. That's us. So just so we all know, just so we're all aware. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hey, Kate, thank you so much for what you do. We all appreciate you.
You bet. Thanks.
And I know you spent a ton of time in research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I, you know, I have no doubt that this is all about control. And, you know, I have plenty of times I can go back and cite where the government did us wrong. So I, you know someone who got polio from the polio vaccine and on and on and on. But my question is, and, you know, my kids are like, but Mom, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is at the, you know, kind of at the forefront of going along with this.
Sure.
The only thing I can think is that we are subject to.
Yeah. I can answer that.
Do you have any feedback on that?
Yes. Let me answer that. I'll take you off the air, though. But I'll answer this.
Thank you.
You bet. I actually answered this in the first part of the show, too, locally. I do a local hour. So, so my church, and this can apply to any church, okay? Churches are typically always going to go with what the government wants them to do. Why? Bigger picture. Churches are about spreading the word of God. They're also about spreading the gospel of Christ, right? You got a lot of Christian churches out there, so I'll speak generally. My church is just like your churches in the fact that they're going to go along with this because you don't want to be the church that stands out, that gets the vitriol from everybody around the world as the church not doing what the government said to do. Okay, it thwarts the bigger picture, missionary work, and all the different things that go on. What if a missionary went to somebody's home? It doesn't even matter what country right now, right? Went to somebody's home, and that family, for some reason, said, and this could be any church, my church, your church, any church, and said, a missionary came to my home and gave us COVID. How do you think that'd go over well in the press? Yeah, that they would take that and run with it. So in order for the liability reasons, in order for all of that, because you don't want to be harnessed by all of that. You don't want that to get in the way of a church family and a church's bigger objective in this. They have to think bigger than that. And I don't blame them for that at all. I as a person can look and see what's going on. My church doesn't have to teach me how to look at news propaganda and understand what's happening. And I think no matter what, they've got to be good citizens, because otherwise they stand to lose, you know, kind of for the bigger picture. It's kind of like on my show, to be frank with you. On my show, there's probably a couple of topics maybe that I could think of that probably will not be a center of discussion on my show. Why? Because I don't want to lose all the other messages I have to take the risk of talking about a couple of things that don't go over well on radio in the United States. I'm just being honest. That's just how it works. It's how our system works. I have to think of the show and the impact it can have and all the other truth that I have to go over. And I'm hoping that by telling the truth on this show and not being bought by anybody and doing all of this as a labor of love, I am hoping that you'll find those things that I'm talking about and you can study them, right? You can study them. I don't need to lead you there. I don't need to do a broadcast live on the radio about them. And I understand in this world right now, with social media turning so quickly on people or organizations, the kind of spot that they're in. I get it. I don't fault them for it. I get it. I understand. In fact, I'm okay with it. And I myself, as an individual, can teach myself how to look at the news and how to see what's going on. And they really are truly having to look at the very, very, very biggest picture, which is really hard for, I think, for us sometimes, you know. We're not in that situation. So with that being said, I'll tell you that the truth is it's a tough thing in this day and age to talk about this, because what we're doing here on this show is going against the grain, truly. And I felt it. Oh my gosh. I have felt it. It's been tough. This has been a hard one. So I'm getting it from all sides. I mean, all sides. And it is, and I know you are too. I'm not the only one. I know you are too. And that's okay, because we never ever thought this wasn't going to be tough. Okay. We always knew that it was going to get harder. It's going to get harder. And that's just the truth of it. There's no way around it. So we're going to just have to deal. So I want to play with you a moth story. This guy was actually writing about an event that happened in his life, and it's called What Doesn't Kill Me. And I hope you enjoy this. What doesn't kill me? You'll like this. And just listen to how his life transformed. And I'm not talking about getting into all the stuff they're telling us to get into, like social distancing. I'm just saying that we can do whatever comes our way. We all have the gifts and talents. We're here for a reason. We were born in this day and time to handle whatever comes our way. So don't be so afraid of when you hear the words Great Depression and all this kind of stuff. You know what? They made it through too. Our ancestors made it through as well. We can too. It doesn't matter what's coming. We'll make it. We'll be fine. So here is Whatever Doesn't Kill Me. Here you go. You'll love this.
You know, you wake up in the morning, you get dressed, you put on your shoes, you head out into the world, you feel like you're going to come back home at night, go to sleep, get up, you do it again. That rhythm creates the framework that you use to create a life, and you make plans, and you kind of count on continuity. And John Lennon said, life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. And I woke up one morning. I wasn't wearing any of my own clothes. I had two chest tubes. I had a hose going up my nose down to drain my stomach. I had a catheter, a morphine drip. And I woke into this fog of pain that felt like I had broken through the ice into a lake of frozen hurt. And at the end of my bed, I could see the surgeon who had spent all night saving my life. And he was holding my foot. And he had given me about a 2% chance of living. Next to him were two homicide detectives. Now, they were homicide detectives because they had gotten the case because they didn't think I was going to make it, and they didn't want to have to do the paperwork swap. And let me tell you, when you start your day with two homicide detectives explaining what happened the night before, it's downhill from there. They had, they began to explain to me, they had five young men in custody, and they wanted me to identify them from the mugshots before I died. And I didn't know this, but they just wanted me to make an X and next to the pictures. And what had happened is that these young men had come in from Brooklyn. They were part of a gang. And the initiation for them to move up into the upper echelons of their gang was to come into Manhattan and kill somebody. And they had set up this little ambush where they had one lookout at either end of the block. And the three guys would sit on the stoop, and they had their knives open up their sleeve like that, and they'd look out at either end, and they would wait. And it was late at night, and it was the night before Thanksgiving, so the city was really empty. And this guy walks around the corner, and he heads down the block, and the two lookouts give the go-ahead, and the three guys stand up and start walking towards him, and he has his key out, and he puts his key in the door, and he goes into the lobby, and the door closes behind him, and they're locked out, and he pushes the elevator button, and he goes upstairs, and he gets undressed, and he goes to bed, and he never knows what just didn't hit him, and I'm the next guy. And I come down the block, and one of the very lucky things from that night is when I was in University of Notre Dame, I was on the boxing team. So I got one good punch and knocked the middle guy out, and they caught him, and he gave up everybody else, which is how they had these five guys in custody. So they, nobody expected me to make it, and I did. I lived. They took me off life support, moved me into ICU, and the nurse comes in with the clipboard, and she wants to talk to me about my insurance. I was self-employed at the time, so I like to say I was insurance-free. And when she found that out, the next morning, the person that I saw said, "It's amazing how well you're doing, and we just think you ought to go home." And they gave me a bottle of Percocet and a cane and a bag to put my stuff in. And the flowers hadn't even stopped.
I'll be right back. The rest of that story in just a moment. Stay with me.
Talk lines are open now. Call 888-673-1450. This is the Kate Daly Show.
Okay, back here with you with the rest of his story. Ed Gavigan is, the story is called Whatever Doesn't Kill Me. He wakes up, he's in a hospital room, he's near death, he's been attacked by a gang, and his life's about to change. And so he's in the hospital, and they just found out he is insurance free, as he put it, no insurance, and they're letting him out. Here's the rest of his story. If I can play it.
The person that I saw said, it's amazing how well you're doing, and we just think you ought to go home. And they gave me a bottle of Percocet and a cane and a bag to put my stuff in, and the flowers hadn't even stopped wilted yet, you know. So I end up in my apartment at home in very bad shape. The nightmares were unbelievable. I couldn't eat. They had removed about a third of my intestines. I had had two collapsed lungs. I was missing organs that I didn't know that I had. And things were very, very difficult. And in New York, if you can't go to work and make money and pay your rent, you don't get to stay in your apartment. And I would try and walk down the street to do my job. I had a little business building custom furniture, and whenever I saw a young man that had any hint of menace, this feeling would hit me. And the feeling was, you know, if you're driving late at night in the winter on a snowy road, you're going a little fast, and you come into a turn, and you feel all four wheels slip, and you feel the car start to go, and you see the guardrail, and you know there's nothing you can do. And then all of a sudden, you hit the dry pavement, and the wheels grip, and you're back in control, and nothing happened. And then you get hit with this adrenaline feeling in the back of your knees and your palms, and you taste in your mouth. But you're driving, and you're like, nothing happened. And I would have that feeling seeing teenage kids on the street 6, 7, 8 times a day if I tried to ride the subway. And it wore me out. I was having, in the end, what was post-traumatic stress symptoms. And I ended up losing my apartment and essentially then becoming homeless. I lost my business. And I went to the district attorney's office for an appointment where I had 5 attempted murder trials that I was I had to handle. And I broke down. I was crying. I was like, I can't believe, you know, I was so lucky to be alive, but now I'm homeless. And he gave me a number for the a little late, I thought, for the victims' assistance people. And but it was because I didn't talk. Like, I just kept it all in. And so I go and I talk to the, I sit there and I don't have an appointment or anything. I'm waiting. And this girl comes out and she's like Reese Witherspoon and Legally Blonde. She's got the turtleneck and the ponytail, and she leads me back to her cubicle. And I'm in this really dark place, and I have this feeling that we're not going to connect. And I get to her cubicle, and pinned up on the wall next to her monitor is that poster. I know you know it, of the kitten with the branch saying, hang in there, baby. And I just don't feel like she's going to help me. And she gives me this paperwork to fill out for Medicaid, and she gives me some more paperwork on how to get on a list for subsidized housing. It's an 18-month wait, but, you know, at least you're on the list. And another sheet with some addresses in the Bronx where I can go for group counseling that's free. And I feel like a drowning man who's just been thrown a kit to build a boat. And I walk out of there, and I go to my favorite bartender, who's this cute Lebanese-Canadian girl who's a poet,
And she lets me move in and stay on the couch. She's rocking this Simone de Beauvoir look, and she's got this whole, like, she's smart and funny. And the thing from those days that she listened, which was amazing, because what people did, and they're all very well-meaning, but they had one of three responses. And the first response was, when I tried to talk about my feelings and my fear and this turmoil in my head, they would say, well, everything happens for a reason. And that made me want to punch him in the face and ask him if they knew what the reason for that was. And then the second thing that people tended to say was, you've just got to get over it, man. You're alive, you're lucky, you've just got to put this in the past and just move on and gather yourself together. And that made me want to stab them six times and come back and talk to them in 6 months and go, so how's it working out? You got any advice for me now? Because I could really use some help from somebody that knows what I'm going through. And the third thing that people would say, and again, they were very well-meaning, it just was absolutely no help, was that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And the problem with that was that I felt like I had come to New York, I'd started this little business, I had built a life, and I had lost everything. I'd lost my apartment, my business, I got no help. You know, this girl that had become, that let me move in with her was like getting a little worried because I was just so sad all the time. And that I felt like you could actually, I mean, I read Nietzsche, I went to college, I was up all night in the student union drinking coffee going, yeah, if it doesn't kill you, man, it makes you stronger. But I felt like I was actually broken, that things could happen in your life that would just break a man, and that you not only you wouldn't be stronger, but you would never have ever again what you had before. And I felt like things had slipped in a way that I would never be able to recover. And what I would do to try and make money and have a job is I would gather my little set of chisels and tools and go up to the Upper East Side, Manhattan, where there's always, you know, some billionaires working on his mansion, and I could see a construction site, and I'd go up and knock on the door and ask if they needed anybody to work, just a day laborer. And the foreman, you know, he sees a guy with his own tools, he knows his way around the job site, English is his first language, and they'd put me on a, you know, they'd be like, all right, you know, put him down there and see what he can do, you know, and I go and I start working, and I knew what I was doing, and I'd be in this incredible mansion being renovated, and I'd look around at the unbelievable materials, and I'd think of how lucky these people were to be living, you know, when we were done with this work, they'd be surrounded by beautiful materials and amazing craftsmanship, and I'd be there, you know, working, and I'd be, you know, making a mortise for an offset pivot hinge in a rosewood door, and the, you know, the beauty of everything that I was working on contrasted with my life, I would just start to cry. And so I'd be on my hands and knees sobbing in the library under construction, and one of the laborers would go tell the foreman, like, you know, that dude you hired, man, he's sobbing in the library. And the foreman, you know, usually this Irish guy would come and, you know, Eddie, here's I'm going to pay you for the day. Go have a drink, man. We don't need you anymore. And then that would be it. I'd get fired. And I was getting fired again and again. And it was always, you know, these people didn't know what happened to me. They just knew they couldn't have some guy weeping in the basement. And I couldn't hold a job. And I was getting angrier, and now, you know, she's my girlfriend, the Canadian poet bartender, but she's worried because I'm like, my attitude is not so good. And I leave after being fired yet again. I walk out onto Park Avenue, right? I've got my little bag of tools, and I see this guy walking by, and he's got his hair is perfectly coiffed, and his Hermes tie is knotted, and his shoes are shine, his impeccable suit with his shiny briefcase. And I see that guy, and I just want to tackle him and just kneel on his chest and punch him in the face and go, you know, you're not good. You're just lucky, man. You're not... You think that all of your assumptions and everything you know and all you're doing is keeping you where you are. You're just lucky, because it can all just be gone. You can lose it. And I have this rage at him. I don't do anything. You know, let him keep walking. But I realize, as I have that feeling, that I have just wanted to hurt an innocent stranger, passerby, to make a point about what is wrong with my life. And in that moment, I realized I've become more like the kids that stabbed me. I've lost who I was before. And I go, it's an incredible feeling to feel like you're not who you used to be. And that the feeling was that I was slipping down into some place where I was going down a road where I was going to meet the guys who were my attackers, and I was going to be in hell because I would go there alone. Like, no, that path was just of bitterness, and there was no way out. And at the same time, for the first time, as I was sitting there thinking about these feelings of what was happening to me, I realized I can never get back to where I was. That guy, that business, that whole life is just gone. I lost it. But I had never believed that I'd lost it. I always thought I was trying to get back to be that guy. And as I sat there and I thought about, I realized I got to do something new. And there was this, it felt liberating. It was like, all right, I can't go back because that's gone. And I don't want to be evil and bad. And I'm going to do this new thing. And I'm like, I can do it. I can do it. I have this girl. And I run home, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be the sad guy, and I'm not going to be the mad guy. I'm going to change, and we're going to work this out. Will you marry me? And she's like, no. You're like, you got to do, you know, we need a little more work here. But she's enthused by my enthusiasm, and she knows I'm never going to ask her again. So after about another year and a half, she feels like we got something. And so she asks me to marry her. And so we do. And we end up building this routine again and setting up a life. And now I have a 2-year-old daughter. And I put her shoes on in the morning, and I head out to work. Thanks.
Isn't that good? Ed Gavigan, Whatever Doesn't Kill Me. You know, I've thought about this a lot because we might be up against some pretty big hurdles coming up. And I think that it's always unknown, you know, what the scary part is, how lives change and how things change. And I do know this, that we're all resilient. We get through things. We have those gifts to do that. And I do know that no matter whatever happens, we're going to be fine. We're going to be okay. You find joy. You live your life. And I tell my kids this so they're not freaked out about the future at all because of the kind of chaotic mess that we're in right now with this manufactured crisis that we're going through right now. The biggest thing is to open our eyes and see what's going on. And we've got to open our eyes and others' eyes so we can fight for our liberty, because it's our God-given gift. So we fight for our liberty. We wake people up out of a thinking coma in America right now, and we do our very best to do that. And then at the end of the day, we know that whatever comes our way, we have done the fighting we can do. We've done whatever we can do, and we'll get through the rest of it. That's how I truly feel. That's what keeps me hopeful. I talk to my kids a lot about this. That's what keeps me going. And I just wanted to share that with you because a lot of us might face a total life upheaval and you find a new way. You find a new path that works. You'll still have joy in all those things. Hi, caller. You got 20 seconds. I'm so sorry. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi. I used to play basketball with your husband.
Nice.
And he was huge and terrifying, but you know, I think you're braver than he is.
I'm telling him you said that. Thanks. That was awesome. Oh, that was awesome. You know what? that was great. We'll be okay. We'll make it through whatever comes our way. I have no doubt in my mind. Our ancestors did it. We do it. It's fine. We'll make it. Anyway, everybody have a great one. Be faithful. Be fearless. Fight for your liberty. Wake people up. Do everything in your power to wake up those around you. And see you back here tomorrow.